And happy birthday to WOWD Radio. Good morning, WOWD LP, Tacoma Park.
Lions and tigers and bears, oh my. Lions and tigers and bears, oh my. Lions and tigers and bears, oh my.
Well, that's, of course, from the classic Wizard of Oz from 1939. And a quote by Dorothy, played by Judy Garland, of course. Welcome to the world of animals with today's show. Good morning, everyone. Today we have a fun show. And for all you animal lovers out there, an introduction to a wonderful and beautiful exhibition at the National Gallery titled The Life of Animals in Japanese Art. The exhibition is in the East Building, and the exhibition goes until August 18th. This is one of these art exhibitions that Sheila, Peter, and I suggest for the entire family. Children and young adults should enjoy this exhibition just like you older folk. You do not need to love animals as nature and beauty has shown with elegance, grace, and incredible expertise and virtuosity. The gallery was packed this weekend, and it surely will be a popular show for everyone. It's surely worth a visit to the National Gallery, which is free and metro accessible. This is one of those exhibitions that Sheila, Peter, and I also learned a lot from. Asian art is, in general, not one of my areas of expertise, but it's so exciting to see an exhibition of this kind that expands your visual appreciation, intellect, with this kind of art, and that's so exciting.
Hi. This exhibition is enormous. It's only half of an even larger exhibit at LACMA, the Los Angeles County of Modern Art. It's 18,000 square feet. It's the whole bottom of the National Gallery. And you can't believe how big it is. It's too much to take in one visit. So plan to go more than once.
So it's like a hike also.
It is. Yeah, you get your exercise in at the same time. It seems endless. But I think if you listen to this show, it'll help organize it for you. And it'll prepare you for what you'll experience. When you enter the exhibition, you're greeted by some of the oldest and newest objects. They face off just outside the exhibition entrance. Three of them are Yayoi Kusama's brightly painted polka dot festooned dogs, and they're barking silently at the visitors. And nearby, right across from them, is an earthenware sculpture of a bridled horse from the 6th century. So they bookend the parameters of what's going to be the great scope of this exhibit. It starts just before the arrival of Buddhism in the 6th century to the present moment in which animals remain essential to art, entertainment, and the pervasive production of such adorable kitsch that strikes visitors to the country as a strange and surreal cultural tick. Hello, Kitty. Buddhism in Japan has been practiced since its official introduction in 552 CE. Buddhism has had a major influence on the development of Japanese society and remains an influential aspect of the culture to this day. Buddhism was imported from China, where it arrived from India about 500 years earlier, and Buddhism brought new animals, including animals not native to Japan, so that the descriptions of animals give life to imaginary beasts like dragons and like elephants with six tusks and legs that bend backward with claws like a lion. This 13th century Japanese response to an unfamiliar animal, because they're told about this animal, but they have to sort of reproduce it from their memory, from their imagination, excuse me. And it has almost the same menacing stance as Albert Dürer's imaginary armor-plated rhinoceros, which is a woodcut from the 16th century. And it's also based on zoological hearsay.
Thank you for bringing that up, Sheila.
Yeah.
That's a very famous woodcut that zoologically is incorrect, uh-huh. But really a beautiful woodcut.
Yeah. So this exhibit is full of extremely rare and ancient objects, as well as contemporary photography, painting, sculpture, and video. The dissonance between the new and the old, plastic and clay, pop icon and historic artifact. And the show uses a thematic approach to give a substantial overview of the history and breadth of Japanese artistic creation. the animals of the zodiac and animals associated with Buddhist deities or protectors were also imported from China and strongly tied to Buddhism. A lion, as invented as the 13th century imaginary elephant, is a central figure in a set of wooden statues of the, from the 12th century, and it depicts a bodhisattva riding a Chinese-looking beast with furrowed eyebrows, red-rimmed eyes, and wide, toothy, roaring mouth. And yet, the figure it bears is serene and childlike and represents wisdom. He carries a sword that is said to cut through confusion and lies. Are you getting interested?
Certainly I am, yes. Have you ever tried to draw, paint, or sculpt an animal? Wow, it's hard, and visually communicating the essence of an animal represents a host of challenges for any artist. It is rare for an animal to sit still for the sitter, unless, of course, it's sleeping or resting. Then there are factors in the nuances of the anatomy, because animals are built differently from humans. To capture an animal correctly, you need to know something about their anatomy. A great example of this in the exhibition is an iron sculpture of a snake. Now, I did my thesis on snake, so I have a good sense of snake in me, but the animal, not the metaphor. Anyway, this snake looks like it wants to crawl out of the display case. It's slithery, and its curves are so unbelievably natural. The snake should have been at the National Zoo. It was that real. But it was made of iron, and I still can't wrap my head around it how they did the scales with iron. Now, Peter had suggested when we saw the exhibit that it must have been hot, right? It must have been, the metal must have been melted.
Yeah, I thought that they probably formed it out of flat pieces that had the scale shape, and they made a circle of it and then put them all together. There was a lot of ingenuity and practice that had gone into making that.
Absolutely. And how they did it, I still don't have an idea, even after Peter's explanation. This exhibition presents many animals in motion with an elegance that is true to the specific animal, and that's a challenge. How to maintain a sense of motion and movement that is characteristic of a certain beast. Many of the animals are also static, whether they are guarding the doors of a sacred temple, like in monkeys and lions, or perched in an architectural setting, especially the sculptures, and there are many of those in the exhibition.
Yeah, I think that's an important distinction. Some of the animals, particularly those from ages ago, are acting in a ritualistic mode. They're simplified and represent valuable human qualities. They're guarding, perhaps, joyfully carrying a saint or standing watch over a grave. Or they're transforming. A dragon climbs an upright sword and then turns around and swallows it from the top. But you were talking about how hard it is to capture the essence. Some of these animals startle you with a posture and expression that captures the living, breathing animal. There's a ceramic hand warmer in the shape of a goat, and I swear it's like looking into the face of a baby goat on the farm. A nice goat, very, very gentle and calming. Right next to it is a hearth cover, two rabbits lying side by side. The life warmth of the two rabbits is palpable, as one of them looks up at you as if just alerted to your presence. Both of these objects are highly domestic in their use, but there's no human character. It takes you away from human proportion, and you encounter the animal world. All of us critters are equal at the center of the universe. Except that hand warmer, I was thinking later, I'll bet the servants heated it up for you. So we're not really all equal.
Oh boy, and the carp. Those carp are such ugly fish, but they're given a place of honor. They're jumping out of the water, jumping through the ice with so much power. The ancient people of Japan honored sacred spirits that they recognized in nature and manifest in mountains, rocks, rivers, and trees. As communities grew, they began erecting shrines where they could worship these deities, and the shrines became centers of regional life and culture. They could transform into sentient beings, and therefore they are sacred. looking at the drawings, whether they are in the embroidery and the kimonos or screens painted on gold leaf or statues in clay and bronze inscribed on pots, the drawings are so fluid. They are the beginnings of animation, or what we now call anime. I think it's just in their blood. The way they tell a story with action drawings that move, that speak without words. A long time ago, I was hired to give art lessons to a little girl who was deaf. She was probably about six, and she drew the same way. She described her trip to the doctor just speaking through her drawings, detailed beyond belief. Her parents, and this was probably 50 years ago, thought that her drawing ability might become a career for her. I had nothing to teach her. She'd rather play with my kids. And even though she could read lips, if she didn't want to do what you wanted her to do, she'd just turn away. She was great.
Good for her.
Yeah, she knew how to handle it.
She needed your lessons.
So for several hundred years in Japan, where even though there was an emperor, the real power was held by the samurai warlords, or shogun. The court favored images of cranes and deer and poems about the moon. The shoguns loved art also, and they favored images of tigers and hawks. Their helmets, this is a big difference from the West, from Europe. The helmets of the shogun, cast and forged out of iron, were in the shape of animals, hawks, fishtails, conch shells. If you've ever seen the samurai movies by Kurosawa, well, of course you have. He wasn't making that stuff up. I was also taken with several depictions of the fox's wedding. This ritual undertaken by the foxes is secret. The foxes do not allow humans to observe. The wedding takes place when the sun is shining as it rains.
That's poetic. That's very, very poetic right there.
And this... And this is true. On that same day that we saw the exhibit, after coming back home, I walked out onto our deck when I saw it raining from a clear blue sky. I looked up. Bright sun, no clouds overhead, and sprinkling rain. I stretched out my arms. It was happening. On my birthday, it was my birthday, and the fox's wedding was going on somewhere right down there in the woods below.
Oh, that's kind of, you're getting creepy now.
Yeah. Later that night, we watched the movie Dreams by Akira Kurosawa, same Kurosawa. This film is going to be shown in a couple of weeks at the National Gallery. It begins with a boy standing wonderstruck in sunlight and rain. He, unlike me who knew better, steals away and watches the fox's wedding procession. The procession comes along through the woods. It's highly stylized kabuki style. It doesn't turn out well for the boy.
Well, I think one of the things about this exhibit, for our listeners, it gives you such a great breadth of Japanese art. I mean, and you know, film, I mean, costume design, I mean, embroidery stuff, textiles. It's amazing. And this is an exhibition that would be a wonder for any student of design. It's thoughtful, it's simple to complex, and beautiful design is one of the strengths of this exhibition. The elements of designs that appear strong and true are line and space. These are really strong in the exhibition, and form also with the sculptures. But I'd like to talk a little about the movement and the use of line as a basic art element. This exhibition is a lesson about the use of sensitive organic line. Organic line is line that exists in nature. It's also called curvilinear or curved line. The curvilinear line depicts these animals so carefully and so beautifully, and it's done so slowly and spontaneously yet carefully. And I think you could see that really wonderfully in the Zen depictions of the monkeys in space. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of ink drawings of monkeys in space and from the Zen period, and it's just so amazing how they've used this line. Organic line implies motion and lends itself to a dynamic movement in a natural form, such as a plant or animal. Linear lines, which are opposite of organic lines, are straight lines, and they don't have to be done mechanically like with a ruler, but they're always static. And static properties in a living And a living object implies resting, sleeping, or possibly dead. And you don't see that a lot. And you don't see too many linear lines in this exhibition at all, because they're depicting mostly movement and life. We invite you to take a close look at the contour edges of the depictions of animals and see the sensitivity, and I really underscore that word sensitivity, and careful observations of the animals themselves. You actually see this in the fantastic animals, and for those of you young ones that want to go see fantastic dragons and multi-species depictions, as Sheila has already said, with the elephant with the six tusks and the lion's claws. I mean, there are many fantastical animals in the exhibition, and you're going to see how they use the contour edges.
I wanted to mention the American artist Martin Puryear. And one of our first ever shows was the work of Martin Puryear, who's an American artist born in Washington, D.C. And he spent a long time in Japan. He was just recently chosen to represent the U.S. in the Venice Biennale, which is a huge honor, and he was the exact right person to be chosen. And he's been able to capture the qualities from Japan of integrity and craftsmanship and quiet contemplation that bring the East and the West together. Somehow, like the Japanese, he breathes life into his simple monumental forms. It really is like his forms are simple, but they really are alive in a kind of animal way.
That would be a good trick to use when looking at a Puryear sculpture, which otherwise might be cryptic. There's a couple of these at our local museum, the Glenstone. Just imagine them breathing.
Yeah, we did a show on Martin Puryear early, one of our first shows. Wow, it seems like a million years ago, because we're going to have our third birthday here in a little bit on WWDLP Tacoma Park. Yeah. So that was a long time ago. But there was his use of sensitive curves. Martin Puryear is really, really well known for that. Well, relating to the use of line in gesture and posture and stance, I'd like to talk about things that specific to the animals that we saw. Like, I'm referring to like the hands of a monkey, or the paws, the claws, the legs, the limbs, the wings of these various, and the tails of these various animals. There's something so specific about looking at these particular nuances in their anatomy. And they're never stiff. There's nothing about these animals that are stiff. They appear in their natural spaces and even standing by themselves. And Peter had brought it up earlier in the show. There's nothing human about them. That's the thing, that they're not anthropomorphized. The heron is looking like a heron, and they're so comfortable in their natural spaces. I teach drawing and painting for students, and I like to summarize the four important points that capture a gesture and a movement, and in this case, in an animal, from an artist's perspective. The criteria are economy of the use of the mark to capture the posture, meaning say a lot with a few marks, and the essence of the pose in understanding the animal anatomical nuances of the movement in the human, or in this case, the animal, or even a tree. And then there's the energy of the mark and its relationship to the kind of movement. And that's very, very much evident in the exhibition, like this carp shooting through the ice. I mean, that's an amazing amount of energy and thrust in that scroll painting, as Sheila has mentioned. And finally, emotion that the mark conveys. So it's economy, essence, energy, and emotion that will enable the artist and the viewer to capture the movement of a natural form. And this show is just full of them.
Yeah, that's what explains the mystery of the goat hand warmer. Energy, essence, emotion, and what was it? Economy. Okay.
Yeah, you know, that goat warmer really stuck out to me too. There's so many wonderful, wonderful pieces in the show, and that one was almost like benignly beautiful. Yeah. It was something so, like, you could pass it, you know, and just keep on walking. There's so many great works, but there was something. There was a conversation between you and that goat. I mean, it was really amazing.
Well, hi again. In case you're just dropping into this show, we're talking about the animal art of Japan on WOWDLP. and
at the exhibit at the National Gallery.
Right, you are.
Yes.
Thank you. So Japan is an island that was culturally insular for a long period, so the exhibition often seems to be about arrivals and discoveries. From the 16th century, Portuguese and then Dutch traders brought animals, which were just as exotic as the lions and the elephants of the Buddhist cultural transfer. A magnificent painted screen from the Momoyama period, which was made around 1600, depicts the trade between what they call southern barbarians, the Portuguese, and the Nagasaki, where a procession of newly arrived merchants, it includes a peacock, parrots, and European hunting dogs. The animals also entered Japanese artistic culture through poetry and literature, which is perhaps the easiest entree for visitors who aren't steeped in Japanese religions or cultures. Poets had a regular storehouse of animal tropes to suggest a mood, analogize some aspect of human frailty or folly or fancy that connects their work with that of earlier poets in a tradition that was deeply conscious of historical precedence. If you spend a little time with Japanese poetry, especially haiku, it helps animate many of the beautiful painted screens and prints in the exhibition. And don't miss the Edo period, the woodblock print, Abalone Fisher Girl with an Octopus, which is a Randy cephalopod. It's well along in its seduction of a bare-chested girl. It's a small work, and it's easily overlooked, but it belongs to a larger tradition of what might be called octopus porn or interspecies erotica.
Oh, my goodness. You've opened up a whole new can of worms,
well,
if I could use the expression.
Well, we know this from the Edo period. Which we've talked about before. Lions are symbolic of the bodhisattvas, and they are the sons of the Buddha, or the Buddha's lions. Bodhisattvas are beings who have attained a high level of spiritual development and have made a vow to renounce the happiness of the highest enlightenment and remain in this world working until all sentient beings are free from suffering. The lions as guardians of the temple are represented in pairs at the entrance of the shrines. The main characteristics of the elephant are his strength and steadfastness. Therefore, it becomes a symbol of physical and mental strength, as well as responsibility and earthiness. In Buddhism, the horse is symbolic of energy and effort in the practice of Dharma. It also symbolizes the air, or prana, which runs through the channels of the body and is the vehicle of the mind.
Described in this from Milarepa, Song of the Galloping Horse of a Yogi. In the mountain hermitage, which is my body, in temple of my breast, at the summit of the triangle of my heart, the horse, which is my mind, flies like the wind. He gallops on the plains of great bliss. If he persists, he will attain the rank of a victorious Buddha. Going backward, he cuts the root of samsara. Going forward, he reaches the high land of Buddhahood. Astride such a horse, one attains the highest illumination. I like that. It's a very active image of the yogi mind.
Yeah, thank you, Peter, for that.
Yeah, thank you. So in a general sense, peacocks are a symbol of openness and acceptance. In Christianity, the peacock is a symbol of immortality. In Mesopotamia, there appeared a symbolic representation of a tree flanked by two peacocks, which is said to symbolize the dualistic mind and the absolute unity. In Hinduism, the patterns of the peacock's feathers resembling eyes symbolize the stars. In Buddhism, they symbolize wisdom. Peacocks are said to have the ability of eating poisonous plants without being affected by them. Because of that, they are synonymous with the great bodhisattvas. The bodhisattva is able to take delusions as a path toward liberation and transform the poisonous mind of ignorance, desire, and hatred into the thought of enlightenment, which opens colorfully like the peacock's tail. Isn't it?
That's great. Very poetic. So you. Pete is rubbing off on you here.
And monkeys. So there's lots of images of monkeys. So Japan has, among others, perhaps, the rhesus macaque monkey. And I don't really know Japanese poets. So I turned to a really good poet who does, who's based in Japan, Gary Snyder. I think he creates a bridge for us to these older ways of perceiving. Walking with friends, here's the poem, Macaques in the Sky. Walking the trail from Nanrin Lake, we see a clear spot in the jungle canopy of leaves, a high point arch of heavy limbs, a lookout on the forest slope. A mother monkey sits and nurses. A couple perching side by side. A face peeks from another leaf screen, pink cheeks, shining eyes. An old male, silver belly, furrowed face, laid back in a crotch. Harsh little cough calls echo. Faces among the leaves, being ears and eyes of trees, soft hands and haunches pressed on boughs and vines. Then, wah, she leaps out in the air, the baby dangling from her belly. They float there. She fetches up along another limb and settles in. Her, arching like the Milky Way, mother of the heavens, crossing realm to realm full of stars, as we hang on beneath with all we have. Enjoy her flight. Drink her light. Rhesus macaque.
Thank you so much, Peter. Wow, that's beautiful.
Oh, man. That's a beautiful, Peter. Thank you. So I want to talk about the cases of the Natsukis. If any of you listeners have read this wonderful book, The Hare with Amber Eyes by Edmund Duval, you'll be fascinated by the Natsukis. And if you haven't read it, I really recommend this book.
Yes, I do too.
Yeah, the book is Duval's investigation of his inheritance of 264 Natsukis, which begins when he received these from his uncle Victor. He went on a sort of a journey to explore where they came from. And so the story takes us to Odessa, Russia. And then it takes us to Vienna and Paris at the time of the Impressionists. The story begins in Paris in 1871, where the author's great uncle becomes an art critic and collector. In addition to becoming an early supporter of the Impressionists, he also latches on to the then prevailing Parisian enthusiasm for all things Japanese. He amasses a collection of 264 Natsukis, which he sends as a wedding present to his cousin Victor in 1899. The story of the succeeding generations is told through the Natsuki, which becomes one of the few art treasures that the family was able to recover from World War II, because a maid who had been employed by the family since she was 14 years old secreted them away in her mattress.
Oh my goodness, that's wild. That's mysterious.
It's a fascinating story. Wow. Yes.
Well, these Natsuki animal sculptures that are really tiny are usually made of ivory and they're decorated. Here again, in such a small scale, the essence of the animal and the details on these small-scale animals is just defies believability with the skills necessary to make these work convey the emotion of the animal. One of my favorites was called the grazing horse, with this absolutely sensual curve of the back of the horse flows around the horse from the to the tail and from the head to the tail, and it's just elegant and simple. I mean, I don't know if I'm using the word elegant too much in the show, but that showcase of those Natsukis was absolutely worth the show alone. I mean, between the hair and I mean, it went on and on. They just captured not only your eyesight but your imagination.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have some pictures of them on the Facebook website where close up, so you can actually see them.
Yeah, I needed to add here that these Netsukis are at the most 2 inches by 2 inches, and they Japanese didn't have pockets, so they had like little sacks, and they would carry these Netsukis in these sacks, and they could feel them, or you know, they're like we used to have rabbit's feet, something like that.
Well, those animals are very different from the images of animals in Western art. The attitudes towards animal is different. For example, rats. Rats disgust us.
Not everybody.
When we're walking in the city at night and you look down the alley beside the restaurant and you see rats jumping out of the garbage bin and scurrying down the alley, we're disturbed.
Yeah, I'll agree with you there.
But in these rooms, the rats are pictured as sweetly as little fawns, clever little beasties eating a radish that some farmer had stored up. And when I got home, I found this quote from a Buddhist sutra. Why should we cherish all sentient beings? Because sentient beings are the roots of the tree of awakening. The bodhisattvas and the Buddhas are the flowers and fruits. Compassion is the water for the roots. This places us all, so that's the Avatamsaka Sutra. This places us all, humans and animals, in the same class of being, the roots of the tree of awakening. So the animals, even the fish and the insects, are related to us. They come up out of the same spirit world that we came from, where maybe our ancestors still dwell. I don't really know anything about ancestor worship, but clearly the world pictured in many of these paintings is alive with spirit. A modern version of this spirit is based in the theory of evolution. And Gary Snyder, again, he lived for many years in Japan, studying Zen, traveling, talking with friends. So here's an illustration. He incorporates this fusion of evolution with ancient worshipful understanding of nature. Here's a poem called New Moon Tongue. Faint new moon arc, curl again in the west. Blue eve, deer moving dusk. Purple shade in a plant realm. A million years of sniffs, licks, lip, and reaching tongue.
Well, thanks again, Peter. That's wonderful. If you've just joined us on the Artist Experience radio show this morning here at WOWLP Tacoma Park, Sheila, Peter, and I are talking about this fantastic exhibition for the whole family at the East Wing of the National Gallery. The Life of Animals in Japanese Art is an exhaustive yet beautiful exhibition covering 17 centuries of Japanese art of animals. It is a selection of about 300 works, and some of these greatest Japanese artists that have ever lived, like Hokusai, Hiroshige, and Kurosawa, are represented in the exhibition. We're going to take a station break, but while we're doing that, in our musical break, please go to our website at tacomaradio.org and think how you can constructively contribute to the great community radio station we have here on the verge of our third birthday. Look at the program schedule and diversity that we have in our programming, and donate it while you're on the web and be a part of this growing radio phenomenon here in Tacoma Park and beyond. Your contributions and donations are tax deductible. Listen in. Thank you.
break. So welcome back. You're listening to WOWDLP Tacoma Park. So anime has become a huge industry. It's a very diverse and it's a popular art form with distinctive production methods and techniques that have been adapted over time with the new technologies. It's an ideal storytelling mechanism. It combines graphic art, characterization, cinematography, and a lot of other forms of imaginative and individualistic techniques. And because it's hand-drawn, anime is separated from reality by a crucial gap of fiction that provides an ideal path of escapism that audiences can immerse themselves into with relative ease. Japanese anime accounts for 60% of the world's animated cartoon television shows.
You know, teaching drawing for so many years, it's amazing how many students come to class with kind of an anime style.
Oh,
they're kind of, nowadays, the young students have been weaned with this anime, and it doesn't matter, you know, from where they come from. They import, like, it's especially interesting in the way how they do the eyes. When they draw the eyes, they draw them really big and open, and the hair has these, like, lightning bolt edges to it, like it's been greased or something. So, you know, the it's you know, I don't know if it's a good thing, but or a bad thing, because they have to kind of like dissolve that out of their vision to kind of look at things in a different way. But it's amazing over the years that I've been teaching, that the new generations, it seems anime has actually affected the way these young people are visually communicating. Well, another aspect of this exhibition deals with a more complicated element of art in Asian art especially, and this is in also the Japanese concepts of space. Asian art has a very different way of depicting space and the relationship of objects in space. This is in contrast to Western art, where the concepts of the foreground, middle ground, and background are shown. Please know that Japanese concepts of showing spatial relationships are just as beautiful as the Western concepts of showing space. And this show is very convincing of this, because there's some wonderful uses of space here. Additionally, one might notice that there's no effort to depict cast shadows as we see in depictions of Western art and forms in space. The cast shadow grounds the figure, and in this case, the animals almost defy gravity. There are many works that have these animals gently and mellifluously floating in space, like herons and birds. It's amazing how light and airy in their spaces they are. And this is very much a distinct character in Asian art, which makes them profoundly beautiful and special. Objects float in space. Of course, that doesn't exist in reality, but the Asian artists have a really tendency to make that beautiful. And I would like our listeners, when they're going to go see the show, to take notice of this huge Sumi ink drawing of this big, huge ox. And it has these blue reins on its around its mouth, and there's no cast shadows under its thick hooves. It's like dancing. It's almost like a ballerina in space, and this is a big ox. And there are many other works that have the same effect in drawing and painting, and there's no shadows on the earth at all. And I also wanted to mention that they use a big white and gold spaces. There's a lot of white space behind these animals and the scrolls and the screens. Mm-hmm. And the fox's wedding was a great example, that the top is almost clearly white. So say they use negative space in a really beautiful way. And I think it's so different from our Western looking at space.
Well, they have a lot of techniques there. Techniques and many different media. We wish we had time to go through them all. Here's just a couple. The Japanese, the woodblock prints, they're so important in Japanese art. And here we have the greats like Hokusai and Hiroshige jump out at us with their color harmonies and the lyrical line work and a sensitivity like no other. They are a real treat. Japanese scroll paintings are bound in the show. They're all with real elegance and taste. The dense, what is this? Design completeness and thoroughness in every aspect of the visual. It's remarkable and distinctively Asian. That way that, you know, instead of having the wooden frame, a lot of them have this, it's on silk, and there's a silk border around it. And there was something, Sheila, you were really taken with that modern version of it.
You know, usually, and I've said this before in shows, but I'm changing my mind. I usually stay away from anything screens, video screens, because I would rather not see something on a screen. But in this mm-hmm. case, there was the most beautiful video installation. It was looked like two screens that are the same proportions as the silk embroidered borders as of traditional screens, and really you can't really tell the difference. And then the scroll area is the color and texture of silk, so you don't know for a while that it's really a TV screen. One screen, and they're blank with this silk, and then one screen has suddenly is visited by a butterfly that's flitting across the screen. And then another by a dragonfly, and it's gentle and slow. And then after a while, there are other insects that are sort of flitting by the screens, and some of them stay until the screens are gently flooded by insects. And then slowly they fly away, just as they came. It's lovely. It's an amazing blend of ancient art and technology.
Oh, that was so beautifully done and so tasteful. One intelligent piece of artwork. Mm-hmm. So are they taking the scroll, the Japanese scroll painting, and they're putting it into the 21st century? Yes. I thought that was remarkable. Well, most people know that I love fabrics and I love textiles, and the show also includes a tour de force of traditional kimonos and kasodes. Kasodes are a short sleeve garment akin to the kimono. Well, there's one 18th century kasode of horse racing, which is mind-boggling. The sense of design is modern. The color palette of a cinnamon red, a vermilion, and pastel blues and greens and a blue-gray. Just a very engaging. I mean, it's so elegant. I'm just not elegant enough to wear such things. But that is one exquisite garment. And then the screens, as we have just talked about in the traditional sense, some depicting foxes, cranes, horses. There's a Sumi painting of horses that is just absolutely amazing. Birds in the marsh and in bodies of water. Well, one of the screens from the 1700s depicts horses secured by ropes in their stable. And this is an interesting piece because there are people and monkeys in the stable space. And it was reported by Portuguese priests at the time that the Japanese stables of nobility were so clean that the royalty entertained and dined in the stable. Now, think about that. I mean, that they dined in the stable. These screens show beautifully the solidity and strength of the horses. Horses are really strong animals, and the Japanese artists really depicted that right on. And it's just a great screen, very interesting to look at. And, of course, Sheila introduced the show with the ceramics that are really strong in Japanese history. There's the Hanawa horse from the 6th century. That's the first thing you and when you enter the gallery. And, of course, it's from the Kofun period, which means ancient grave. And these animals were found at grave sites as spiritual symbols that accompanied the dead. They're dogs, chickens, ducks. It's amazing how the Japanese just they tilt the animal's head, and it gives it so much personality. I had to mention this, Sheila, but you talked about Kusama's fun, playful, modern animals in the beginning, and I heard the museum guard say at the museum that they were an absolute nightmare for the security guards because the kids ran into the gallery and wanted to jump on them to play. I mean, there's no climbing on any sculptures here.
That's interesting. If you just joined us on the Artist Experience Radio Show, we're here at WODLP Tacoma Park. Tom and I are discussing a beautiful exhibition, one for the entire family at the East Wing of the National Gallery, The Life of Animals in Japanese Art. And it's a joy of the natural world, covering 17 centuries of Japanese art of animals, plants, water, air, and everything natural. I wanted to say the scale of these works is so varied, from the 2-inch Natsukis to huge, huge mural. And yet somehow the contemporary stuff, especially this enormous mural at the end of the exhibit, has for me a lot less power than like the Hirojiji small prints and somehow scale, I think, is the enormous scale doesn't have the same power as the smaller things.
You know, Sheila, so you hit on something here, and I agree. But you know what I think they lacked at the earlier Japanese works from different kind of religious Buddhism, Zen, the Shinto religions? They lacked a bit of spirit. They were almost kitschy, and I think the spirit was lacking in the more modern works. There's something imbued in those old animal works that had spirit that the modern ones lack.
I agree. I mean, I think it's cute. Some of the new anime things are very cute with their little eyes, but they don't have what the older things have. They really don't.
Well, it's sort of maybe a dessert.
Oh, okay. We can say it's a dessert. Yes.
I'm on a diet, Peter.
Well, and the exhibition ends with a room full of dresses that are designed by Issei Miyake, and they're pleated forms that recall creatures from the monkey to the cicada to the starfish. Along two walls of this large and final gallery is Takashi Murakami's giant 2014 painting, In the Land of the Dead, Stepping Over the Tail of a Rainbow. And it's painted in response to the devastating 2000 earthquake and tsunami. It too is full of animal figures, as well as references to the Edo period and the 13th century works.
Well, we're going to be wrapping up the show in a bit, but I wanted to go back to that carp breaking through the ice, which is just an amazing depiction of a carp jumping out of the ice and another carp venturing towards the hole in the ice. Mm-hmm. Depth and distance are achieved here with a sense of transparency, with delicate washes of ink on silk. And that's where the virtuosity comes in these works. We could use the word delicacy and sensitivity 1,000 times in the show, but the softness of the water and the tail of the fish in the distance makes for a beautiful, subtle depth. Interestingly enough, the shards of ice that are not transparent are in the foreground, and they're sharp and linear, capturing the dangerous ice which the carp has just broken through. Cheryl and I have said so many times on our show, and I think this is the 75th show, how important good observational drawing is done and needed to make these animal works successful. And this is just another one of those exhibitions that truly do that. We talked about this as almost a religion with John Ruskin and the American Pre-Raphaelites. You have to capture the sense of realness by looking closely. And this is the same for these amazing Japanese artists. They're depicting zoological and botanical subjects so profoundly accurately. Anyway, another thing to close up is the use of the precious metals. Gold and silver and copper are used elegantly. The room with the samurai works, they have an entire taxidermied horse with a samurai warrior. And we've talked about the great film director and writer Akira Kurosawa, his famous films Seven Samurai and Ron. are thankfully included in the exhibition. And do you remember Kurosawa was the absolute rage in the 80s? I remember my students were really big into the samurai, all because of Kurosawa.
Well, I wanted to say, which I didn't say in the beginning, but go on our Facebook, Artist Experience Facebook page, and look at the images we've put there, and then go to the show, because you're never going to see this stuff again. So much of it is just for this one show, and take your kids or the grandkids or some friends. It's easily and happily, with the exception of one slightly naughty octopus, interesting for everyone. It's got textile ceramics, a magnificent 19th century footed bowl with crabs, and it's a stunner. Armor, weapons, masks, figurines, and dishware. And it's also a rich and intellectually rewarding show that makes the power of cultural exchange real. That is a very important thing about this show. If you have time to engage with the more 300 works on view, many of them national treasures, the animals depicted become a bit of a pretext for a larger study of Japanese artistic traditions. But if you just want to go look at animals, a deer painted with strokes that are so feathery they seem like tufts of fuzz on the image surface, or a monkey with a long arm reaching foolishly or with human faith in the impossible for the reflection of the moon on placid water, the exhibition is equally absorbing. No matter which approach you take, you'll leave wanting more and wishing you could spend more time in a country that was less than a century ago a fierce imperial power and the enemy. And now, to borrow from another animal image, a painting by Edward Hicks that seems curiously a peaceable kingdom.
Yes, thank you, Sheila. Yeah, mm-hmm. the life of animals in Japanese art at the East Wing of the National Gallery is one of those exhibitions that's easy on the eye, with great variety of subject from the animal kingdom, fantastical animals from the Japanese artist's imagination and creativity. The exhibition is a menagerie that will simply keep you engaged in a beautiful way. It presents a great number of art techniques of the rich traditions of Japanese art. And I think I have to go back, Sheila, because I actually missed that octopus that you were talking about. And so you know, I missed the most devilish of all the ones that, thank you for reminding me. We've learned a lot, and that's always a joy in seeing a great art exhibition. So we hope you've enjoyed the show. Sheila, are we going to keep our next show a mystery or what?
Oh, we usually do, because we never know what's going to grab our attention. You know, we have 2 weeks between shows.
And so, too much attention.
Too much attention.
Well, you know, Sheila, I think I'd like to take our listeners to the Freer Gallery and
that's
see that
a wonderful idea.
Whistler in watercolor. Whistler was one of those bad boys in art, and I think we need to check out a bad boy. We haven't checked out a bad boy in a long time.
Yes, awesome.
So he could really paint. And I think we could come maybe that in the next show. Well, stay tuned to our next exciting program, programming at WOWDLP Tacoma Park. We have, of course, the famous Bobby Hill with this music. He's on the airways. He's in print media, and Bobby shares the incredible knowledge and musical depth with his great musical program every Saturday from 10 to 1 p.m. This music, avant-garde jazz, is right here. So keep that dial fixed for Bobby to take over and give you that vibe for the Saturday morning. We invite you to listen next Saturday to Robin's Radio in our time. And then it's an opportunity to listen to radio for our youth and bring out the child in everyone. In our time slot next week, we have 9 to 10 Saturday, Lost Treasures by DJ Mackey. He's one of our musical archaeologists. Lady Merle and Milo are hosting Borderlines on Wednesdays from 10 a.m. to noon, and our friend Gail Behrens from 8 to 10 p.m. on the night ride home. Experience art and the visual in everything you do, and thanks for listening, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly. All your life, you were only waiting for this moment to arise. Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these sunken eyes and learn to see. All your life, you were only waiting for this moment to be free. Blackbird, fly. Blackbird, fly. Into the line of a dark black night.
And you're tuned to WOWDLP Tacoma Park.
This wonderful feeling.